Almost all citizens of Alvarado inherited from the terribly red dictatorship an apartment, which the happily blue democracy gave to them as a gift. The value of the red-blue apartment is $25,000. Thanks to a terribly simple alchemic formula, the villager citizen, within 3 months, becomes the owner of 4 times $25,000, in other words, of $100,000. From Apollon Bache, Dita Information, February 1996. Writing in the economics section of Dita Information, Daily Information, in early 1996, journalist Apollon Bache introduces the allegory of Alvarado, a pun on Albania as El Dorado. Alvarado is intended as both parody and cautionary tale, warning citizens against selling their apartments, acquired under socialism, and newly privatized as personal property, for cash to buy into the pyramid schemes that were all the rage in the early 1990s. Through the allusion to the fabled city of gold, Bache evokes the euphoria that permeated the everyday reports, rumors, and firsthand accounts of quick and effortless cash gains from companies that claimed to lead the way to emerging capitalism. So that is from Smokey Musaraj, Tales from Alvarado, The Materiality of Pyramid Schemes in Post-Socialist Albania, in the journal Cultural Anthropology, page 84. All right, welcome back to Warming Up to the Cold War, the podcast that explores the most colorful stories from the Cold War era. My name is Shelby Riedel, and I'm excited to welcome back Sarah Turek as a guest for this episode.
Hello, thank you for having me again. I'm excited to hear all about today's story.
All right, so first let's talk about some terms. So Sarah, are you familiar with pyramid schemes, MLMs, and or Ponzi schemes?
Yes, I have had the misfortune of knowing people who have been misled or misguided into thinking it's a, you know, viable way to make money, because my understanding of a pyramid scheme is, like a pyramid, there's only a few people at the very top making money, and it's a sort of reverse trickle-down thing where you have to have at least a pile of people beneath you actually selling and making money in order for you to make any money.
Yeah, exactly. So what are some red flags that you've noticed where if someone uses certain terms or
catchphrases
that you're like, ah, I know what you're in.
Be your own boss.
Yep.
Set your own hours. I'm realizing this kind of sounds like if you're a freelancer. That's not what I mean. I mean if you're working under somebody else in a long chain of people and you're selling trinkets and or makeup and or, I don't know, scrubby pads or, you know, like I'm thinking of just like weird little items that you can find at a store, but people sell individually and they usually host parties to sell them, whether it's cosmetics and soap or dishes and cooking ware, Tupperware too, or plastic containers, I should say. I don't know if it's actually the Tupperware brand. I don't want to throw them under the bus.
I think it is because Tupperware parties became a phrase.
So. You're right. So while they still sell in stores, I guess they're also doing that. That's odd. So yeah, that's my understanding. It's kind of a trap of making people think they're becoming independent when really they're getting suckered into a scheme where they spend all their time and money buying stock or buying supplies, and then they have to frantically sell it off at even lower prices trying to get back what they lost.
Yeah, so what you were describing is multi-level marketing schemes, because the distinction basically is that multi-level marketing schemes, they have a product at least. A pyramid scheme is where there is no product.
Oh.
So one that I was kind of exposed to was there's this group, something similar to the name of Girl Bosses of Fargo Moorhead, where they wanted you to pay $100 to join. They were upfront like, that supports the people who have been in this longer. And then after you've been in it for a while and new people join, then you'll get some of their money.
Wow.
Yeah. I never joined it. It sounded really sketchy. I was like, this doesn't seem right. But
they didn't even try to say it was a platform for entrepreneurs to network together and make business deals. They just said
maybe that. But like, it was clear the primary purpose was this investment aspect of it.
Oh, boy. Okay, so I guess I didn't know what a pyramid scheme was. I thought that pyramid scheme and multi-level marketing were interchangeable, but.
No, there's a big legal distinction because pyramid schemes are explicitly illegal. If someone Facebook messages you or something and with their little spiel and you're like, you're in a pyramid scheme, then a lot of times they'll say, no, it's a multi-level marketing thing because they're like, well, this is the legal version. But it's kind of like barely legal because the only way you can be successful is by having, like you said, you have to have that big downline of all these people under you. It's not a sustainable business because with the pyramid, it has to have exponential growth for it to keep growing as a pyramid because you require more and more people at the bottom. I watched a video called The Pyramid Scheme That Collapsed a Nation by Rare Earth on YouTube, and then they said one of the signs of a pyramid scheme is massive growth at the onset, but it's unsustainable for it to keep growing. The problem is that once it is growing, it appears to be successful, then that's when you get the most people buying into it, and that's right before it collapses, because that's when it kind of reaches the breaking point where they can't pay back the people anymore. So this is from The Rise and Fall of the Pyramid Schemes in Albania by Jarvis, page 7. So first step, early investors are drawn in by advertising promising high interest rates or huge capital gains after a short period. Most schemes have a gimmick, often based on some real or imagined market inefficiency or loophole in the law. Step 2. News of the high return spreads by word of mouth or advertising, and more people invest. Their payments are used to pay interest, and if necessary, principal to the early investors. More often, though, the early investors will reinvest their principal and sometimes their interest in the hope of still higher gains. Most people, however, remain skeptical. Step 3. With a reputation for solvency based on a good payments record, which overrides doubts about the feasibility of the scheme, many more investors come into the scheme. Some remain skeptical but invest anyway, believing it can make a quick profit and then get out before the scheme runs into trouble. For a time, the scheme appears successful. Step 4. The final stage is the collapse of the scheme. The interest and principal due to the old investors exceeds the money that the scheme is able to attract from new investors. As soon as payments are interrupted, confidence in the scheme evaporates. The investors rush to get their money out, but there's little to be had. What has not been paid to the early investors in interest has usually been used to buy highly visible, but often not very valuable assets to make the scheme look prosperous, or has been stolen outright by the operators.
Weren't we just talking this week about how the LuLaRoe clothes selling thing kind of collapsed in this fashion?
Well, because LuLaRoe had a policy where if you wanted to get out, then the company would buy back the clothes that you had in stock at your house. Once they changed their manufacturers of the clothing, they had a pretty good setup, but they wanted a higher profit margin, so they switched, and the quality of the clothes went way down. Then a lot of their sellers were like, hey, like, I don't support this company anymore. But so many of them tried to get out that the company couldn't afford to pay them all the money for the clothing, so they ended that policy. More people got mad, and so some people did some kind of sales on Facebook where it's like a shirt for a dollar, like they just wanted to get rid of it. But what we saw was there was a whole section of a thrift store that was just that brand because of how quickly that the whole thing collapsed, and people were just like, I'm done with it. I just want to get space back in my house.
I remember seeing a Facebook Marketplace ad and I laughed actually. I didn't know that this business was collapsing. I just saw that someone, their mom or grandma, was done with the brand and they had like giant garbage bags full of LuLaRoe clothing. And they're like, if someone wants to come, it's this many dollars a garbage bag full of clothes. And at the time, I laughed because I was like, what are they doing? I didn't realize the whole brand was collapsing.
Gears are clicking now. You're
Yes,
like,
they are.
oh, that's what was happening.
I'm learning all kinds of things today.
Yeah. Well, that's the idea, is that we're learning, but we're having fun with it. Right. So, one of the articles I read by Smokey Musaraj, they argue that the pyramid schemes in Albania, which that's what they're termed in most of the articles and newspaper articles from that time period, they actually function more as Ponzi schemes because quote, participants in pyramid schemes make their money by recruiting new investors, whereas Ponzi investors are drawn in by the promise of high returns on lucrative assets or guarantees of state bailout, unquote. And that's from page 85. So if it was a true pyramid scheme, then the Albanians would have had to go and talk to friends and family and try to get them involved. Albania was transitioning from communism to capitalism, and so the state was like, hey, do you want to buy these factories and these like state-run farms that we don't really have a use for anymore? And so these companies would buy the properties and then just do nothing with them, but market it as if, oh, we invested in this farm and it's a new opportunity for wealth. And so it was just kind of covering the actual process of how the money was being generated.
Okay.
So as I mentioned, they were one of the countries in the communist bloc. And when communism collapsed, then the new leaders in Albania decided, we'll just kind of use the shock therapy model because we're already so behind because of communism that we need to catch up as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with that is that that's such a different mindset that people have to have in order to adjust. It's like a different system for people to operate in, and you have to be more careful and responsible with how you're spending your money in order to make it in that kind of society. And they didn't give people any consumer protection laws, any education on just how to kind of adapt their lives to this. So that was a big part of why this was allowed to happen in Albania.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like they were kind of like, freedom, do whatever you want. We don't know how to like regulate this yet, but go for it.
Well, and then the thing is as Fred C. Abrahams mentions in his book, Modern Albania, is that they actually had help from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. They were giving Albania advice on how to jumpstart their economy and stuff. And so in the very early 90s, then inflation decreased and production rose and growth reached a reported 11% in 1993. And so they're like, wow, Albania is growing so fast. This is proof that our advice is like top notch.
Mm-hmm.
But Albania was kind of muddling the numbers because in areas like agriculture, there's often not very much certainty about what the exact profits are and stuff, just because there's so many individuals operating those farms and stuff. So then they would estimate on the high end, and they wanted this good press about, oh, they're the fastest growing economy in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to recover. But Albania was still the poorest country in Europe. Like, regardless of that growth, they still weren't catching up to their neighbors even. And so it took until 2000 for their GDP to reach what it was in 1989 when communism was still the system there.
Hmm.
They had a lot of poverty in their country. A lot of workers left Albania and worked in Italy or Greece, and then they sent home money in foreign currency to their families. And because the currency in Albania wasn't worth very much, then to have Italian money or Greece money, and this was before the euro was a thing, but just to have like this foreign currency that was more stable than that was worth a lot. So mm-hmm. these families could do pretty well even relying on a single income. And then there are problems with the federal government. For one, there's a lot of long wait times for deposits and loans at state banks, where you had to wait like between 1 and 2 weeks for your deposit to go through for a loan to be processed. So it wasn't even really usable for a lot of people when you had to wait that long. And then people didn't trust the federal government because they just left a system where the state had way too much power. And so they were like, you know, I think I can manage my assets, my interest. And so they kept their money in cash. And so people would literally stuff their mattresses full of cash. Like, they would just hide cash everywhere because if the state has some control over it, if it's in a bank, then you don't know what could happen to it. So it's more safe to keep it in a mattress.
Okay, I was just going to ask if people were hiding it under their mattress. No, they're filling their mattress with money.
Yeah.
That couldn't have been comfortable.
Yeah, it was just like wasn't a good system. And so you can kind of see like just how little options these people had, where you can't have like a savings account at the bank because it's so frustrating to get any money back out of the bank. but you want your money to do something rather than just, you know, fill up a mattress. So they're kind of looking for some opportunities.
Yeah, some other revenue options. And if they had good enough advertising, I guess these Ponzi schemes, like, look, we just bought a factory. Invest in our factory.
Yeah. A little bit about some of these companies from Musaraj, Tales from El Borrado, page 97. As Zogaj points out, the pyramid schemes known as company, such as VEFA Holding, Jalika, Canberry, Senaj & Co., and Silva, presented an image of capitalist entrepreneurship embodying the spirit of post-socialist reform that valued private enterprise and an openness to international capital. This image is crucial to understanding the credibility of these firms and their promise of guaranteed returns on creditors' deposits, unquote. So they were really manipulative and trying to get people to believe our company's existence is just proof that Albania is becoming a capitalist society. This is how we catch up. This is how we innovate. A lot of Albanians were initially skeptical about this, but a lot of Albanians that were interviewed by Musaraj, then they talked about, oh yeah, like I talked to this guy and he was talking about these investment opportunities and I was like, eh. But then they got taken to banks or to office spaces where there's just piles and piles of cash. So being able to see concrete evidence of money, then that kind of convinced people, okay, they actually could fulfill their huge promises of these 3-time, 4-time returns on investments.
That's huge. People shouldn't believe that big of a claim.
Yeah, but, and so, and that's like, they didn't initially, but there's some proof that of there being money that was going around. And additionally, the Albanian government was very passive towards the pyramid schemes. They kind of knew how they were operating, but a lot of government officials invested in them, so you couldn't convince them to do investigations, to like, pass stricter laws, whatever.
Oh, because they thought they were going to get rich, or they wanted to believe they would get rich. Yeah. They're like, no, don't shut down my favorite factory. Oh.
Yeah, and then the ones that weren't invested, then they thought, well, maybe these companies are right that this is just capitalism. And so they were just kind of hoping things will be okay. They just didn't want to deal with the fallout from the public because so many people in the public were invested and wanted to gain wealth. Mm-hmm. So they didn't want to be the ones that were like stomping on that dream. And then when there's people that in the government that have that dream, then that makes it all the more difficult to do.
Right. Plus, oh my goodness, this is so crazy. So they're all super invested in it. Or if you're not, the government would probably be afraid of backlash.
Yep.
Because how do you act like a good government and take away all these people's investments?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And then the ties with politics got a little too close for comfort in the 1996 election. Again, this is from Musaraj's article. Quote, in the 1996 elections, just 6 months prior to the collapse of the schemes, the incumbent party, Partia Democratica, under Berisha's leadership, led the campaign with the slogan, "With us, everybody wins." The PD slogan intentionally used the double meaning of fito, to win, to suggest that gains from the schemes were also made possible by the government, unquote. Directly making that connection between their party and the continued growth and success of the schemes.
I mean, doesn't every politician want to claim credit for economic increases and like, oh, look how many jobs were in my district. Look at how many people were hired. Like, I'm definitely, my party is definitely helping the economy and these people. You know, like that's not unusual for a politician to say.
It just gets messy here when, like it says, it was 6 months prior to the collapse, so that slogan didn't get them very far, because once it collapses, then people want to kick your party out along with the top executives of the schemes. Yeah. Just to give a sense of how rampant these schemes were running, estimates range from $1.2 billion to $2 billion invested by Albanians during the 90s. And so the population at that time was around 3 million, I believe. And so then that was between 50 to 60% of Albania's GDP.
Oh.
That's from Abraham's Modern Albania. So yeah, it was a lot of money. So there's basically everybody bought in, like, or had a family connection or something where you were impacted by this in a pretty close way.
Mm-hmm.
On paper, Albania was prospering right up until the moment that the pyramids collapsed. And then the economy crashed because the economy, like half of the economy was the pyramid schemes.
I can't imagine that. Everyone here in America, mm-hmm. everyone knows somebody who's at some point in their life, you know, a college friend or somebody who all of a sudden online is saying, hey, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm mm-hmm. selling these things. But they're not really an entrepreneur because they're just doing what someone else told them to sell.
Yeah.
You know? So, but if for everyone to either be involved, yeah, it's like half the people are involved mm-hmm. and half the economy is, that's, oh, that had to be a big fallout.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about the fallout more after our break. All right, we're back. And what are we going to talk about, Sarah?
The collapse of a nation.
Yeah.
Or at least its economy. Here we go.
Okay. So right before the collapse, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, they were kind of being as like passive-aggressive as they could about that. Albania was their little poster child. Like, they had been growing. And we said before the break, on paper, Albania looked awesome right before the stuff started to collapse. So the IMF was just like, hey, like, we think it would be a good idea for you to investigate this, but, you know, whenever you're ready. So it was very passive. But finally, in November of 1996, and they gave a press conference to the Albanian public and were urging the government to start a formal investigation. And that same day, the scheme called SUDA defaulted on its payments. So they kind of gave their warning at like the last possible moment for it, because like at that point then people lost a lot of money.
Well, of course, but what could they have done? I mean, it would have been possible if they had been investigated a little earlier for them to be forced to repay people's investment.
Yeah, they were able to freeze some accounts. There's a couple of the bigger ones, they weren't able to freeze the biggest one. The biggest one was able to still operate after the collapse.
What?
But yeah, so there's a couple instances where they were able to freeze the accounts and seize assets and then pay people back. But I mean, I think it happened for less than half of the schemes. So.
Oh, so that would be less than a quarter of the economy, right? Less
yeah.
Than a quarter of the GDP.
Roughly. I mean, like, the schemes were of different sizes, but yeah.
Right. Oh, boy. Okay.
In an article called Bad to Worse, Albania from The Economist in February of 1997, quote, of 9 ailing financial schemes, 4 have crashed, and the rest are wobbling badly. But by far the biggest scheme, run by a company called VIFA, is still afloat just. If it goes under, Mr. Berisha, the president, will be gasping. If he fails to compensate investors, there will be more riots. If he pays and the lek dies in value, Western lenders, led by the International Monetary Fund, may withhold support, unquote. So that just demonstrates, even like from an international perspective, people knew that the president was really in a tight spot because you had to pick between riots and international support.
Hmm.
The government was just kind of like praying like that things would kind of be normal, or just like that these pyramid schemes would kind of fade out and normal business things would happen, but they weren't prepared for the fallout of the collapse at all.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how could you be? That's nuts.
It got pretty bad. So even before this article in January of 1997, Triton Shehu, who was the foreign minister, deputy prime minister, and head of the Democratic Party, was sent to speak to demonstrators at a stadium in Lushnje. So the protesters there were like, hey, we want to speak to someone in the government, like, we're going to negotiate.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sent this guy because he had a lot of big responsibilities, but he had no security because people in the police and the army had also invested in the schemes. So they were also mad at the government. So people were deserting their posts at the stadium. They like tossed their hats off and joined the crowd. They were like, hey, we have demands. And so this dude, like, I feel bad because his intent was to stop the violence because he was worried about how many people would die because of this. Mm-hmm. And so he was trying to be like a peacekeeper, try to keep things together, and he was willing to negotiate. But there was no chance for that because he had no security. And so almost immediately after he got into the stadium, someone hit him in the head with a crowbar. And then people were able to get super close to him. And so they were beating him with fists and leeks, because leeks were one of the last things available in the grocery store in communist Albania. So it was a symbol of how poor people were, because now that they lost all of their investments, then they had to resort to eating some just like essential vegetable that mm-hmm. would just keep them going. And so, yeah, he got beaten with vegetables and stuff. So it was really bad. And especially like for this guy that he wasn't the main guy responsible. Like the president was super stubborn about this. Like the president was probably more to blame. But the Democratic Party, which is actually more on the right side of Albanian politics, and the Socialist Party, they both decided that the depositors would not receive money from the government to compensate for their losses. So as I mentioned before, the only chance you would get for getting your money back is if the government was able to seize the assets in time before the collapse.
Right.
Yeah, this didn't go over well with the public, obviously, because they're like, you're the government, you didn't put any protections to keep these in check. You knew how big these were getting and how much was at stake. You didn't do anything. You were passive, like, up until things started to fail. So mm-hmm. people felt really let down by their government. It broke into anarchy. The stadium incident was kind of a foretaste of what was to come. And so the government had no authority, because a lot of people blame the government for what happened. And then so many people in law enforcement deserted their posts. So, like, there's no way to enforce the law or keep the peace, anything.
Yeah.
And so over 2,000 people were killed during this. They lost control of the South first, because the South had more investors per capita than mm-hmm. the North did. But, like, there's whole cities where, like, it was just anarchy. And tens of thousands of people were impoverished because either they invested everything. Like, there's stories of people, like, in the introduction, people selling their houses, their apartments, selling their farms, even selling their farm animals. They would take them to market just so they could invest more in the schemes. So people didn't have anything left. Or in the course of the anarchy, their property was destroyed because there's so much looting going on.
Right. This story took a turn. I thought it was just going to be a lighthearted, like, oh, no. There were some con men. This is awful. Oh, yeah. My gosh.
And then something that would also create a lot of problems for the future is that an estimated 1 million weapons were looted from the government.
Oh.
So that is talked about in the Jarvis piece, pages 16 and 29.
Hmm.
So that anarchy went on for several months, but then in July of 1997, the Socialist Party gained control because they did have an election. I'm not really sure how that happened, but the president, Berisha, said, okay, like, if my party loses, then I'll step down. But he was refusing to leave or do anything to fix the situation. Yeah. And so finally, when his party lost and they're like, bro, you need to leave, then he did leave. And so then the Socialist Party got control of the parliament and be a coalition. And they got help from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
Had kind of contributed to this problem.
Yeah. But
pretty responsible as well for not stopping them.
And so there were some pyramid schemes that were left. And so then the recommendation from these international associations was to have them controlled by government administrators to kind of phase them out. So that was from the Jarvis piece again, pages 17 and 18. And then from Jarvis, page 25, quote, it appears that no new pyramid schemes have emerged in Albania since the crisis, something that might appear unsurprising, but has not always been the case in other transition economies where large pyramid schemes have flourished. To a large extent, this must be due to the political and public consensus that the burden of the losses should be borne by the depositors, not taxpayers, unquote. In the long term, it seems to have been the right decision for the government to not bail out and provide payments to the people who invested in the schemes, because then it kind of taught them a very hard lesson that you are responsible for your own investments. And so then now, like, no one's interested in a pyramid scheme because you know that no one's going to help you if it crashes and burns.
Right. And I mean, that's kind of part of with capitalism. You're responsible for your own money. And if you make a bad investment, that's on you. Like all these crazy cryptocurrency things, like people have lost their life savings because, again, it was going up in value and people were jumping on and the, you know, trying to be with the popular thing. And then they lost their money. And that's how the stock market works.
The Economist piece that I mentioned from February of 1997, that in the beginning it called Albanians foolish for investing in the first place. But as like we talked about with how many MLMs are active and prominent and how many times the stock market has crashed and, you know, people kind of gamble on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like you can't say that Albania is unique and that they weren't cautious enough, because this happens everywhere, that there's capitalism, that people want to get rich, and so they'll kind of make decisions that aren't super well thought out, and then they have to pay the price for that. But with Albania's situation, it is like really understandable how it got to this point, but it's just sad that the government and these international organizations, they knew that it was bad and it, like, they couldn't turn it back, and they just kind of watched it collapse.
Yeah, it's definitely much worse than it could have been if, well, if those, like the IMF and the World Bank, they had intervened, or if the Albanian government had intervened sooner. Yeah, that's hard. Because, like you said, so many of the government officials were investing in it too, so they didn't want to stop it. Ugh, that's frustrating. Yeah.
Today, Albania is one of the least developed European countries, and is a candidate for accession into the EU. They actually had, they were supposed to have their country discussed as one of the possible candidates for the EU in March of 2020. Obviously, that was not a good time. But it is like very recent that they're being considered for this. So because that meeting was like just over a year ago, no steps in the process have been completed yet. And in the YouTube video, The Pyramid Scheme That Collapsed a Nation, the host of that video like walks around Albania, and there's a lot of just like empty buildings and stuff. So there's certainly like growth in the cities and stuff, but there's just like evidence of loss, like losses in terms of the economy. The quote we'll end this story on is, "The answer to unchecked communism is not unchecked capitalism," and that is from the Rare Earth YouTube video.
That's a very good point. Yeah, if there aren't regulations put in place, gullible people will be taken in no matter what the system is. And sometimes you think, oh, these regulations are infringing upon my freedom. Well, it's for a good reason.
Yeah.
It's kind of like seatbelt laws. Oh, now you don't have the freedom to break dance in your car while driving? Well, gee, it's to keep you safe and to keep other people safe, too. Like, it's not... Oh.
I think this story is good for more people to be aware of the extremes of what can happen if we don't have regulations. That I think that it might be a wake-up call for people and just... You don't want to have to lose everything in order to be more fiscally responsible.
Right. And it's not, we're not saying that capitalism is perfect either, but I have to say it's a lot better, or a lot more options and opportunities than communism. So that's one thing from the whole Cold War dealio for your podcast, warming up to the Cold War. On behalf of the Bad Idea Corner, my own podcast, I would like to recommend not doing anything with the multi-level marketing scheme. Please and thank you. That's my very good idea.
Yes. So, yeah, Sarah just talked about her podcast, which is super fun. She does it with her brother Luke, and it's just so fun to listen to them talk about like a bunch of random things. And speaking of that podcast, I will be a guest on that episode, so I'll make sure that there's links up to that so you can check that out. So yeah, a lot less learning, but it should be yeah, a little more fun.
It's a bit more of a talk show than anything. It's all sorts of random ideas. We invent and discuss all kinds of ideas and decide whether they are bad ideas or if they're really good ones that somebody should try out.
And I'd like to thank all the people who have listened to this episode. This month, there's been a ton of new listener countries. We have Portugal, Finland, Denmark, Sweden, New Zealand, Turkey, Brazil, Mexico, France, India, and Greece added to the list. I appreciate you all for tuning in. If you're a longtime listener, I appreciate you so much. Please reach out and say hello and if you have ideas for the show. The podcast host is Anchor, and the theme song is Oblivion by Jack Fluck. You can find the show notes at shelbyriedel.org, so I'll have all of the sources that I used and also some recommendations for further learning if you're really interested in this topic. You can email at warmingupod@gmail.com and reach me on Twitter at warmingcoldwar and Riedel Shelby, so that's R-E-I-D-L-E-S-H-E-L-B-Y. All the listening platforms, I think I'm available pretty much everywhere. If there's options to rate and review, please do that so I know what I can do better. But until next time, for both Sarah and I, have a great week.